Hey, what's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning into another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is Monday, May 28th, Memorial Weekend. Great guest today. It's going to be a handmade episode. Ivana Manley is here from Manley Labs. It's going to be all hi-fi here today. Hi-fi audio equipment. You know how I love the vinyl, the turntables, the amplifiers, the preamps, the tubes. Oh, man, that is a rabbit hole. People always hit me up, what kind of gear should I get? Fuck, I don't know, man. It is just, the sky's the limit. You could pay from $100 to, well over $1 million on a system. It's just crazy. And you could YouTube up some audio equipment, high-end stuff. And you'll lose your mind. I've seen some shit in stores that just knocks me out. You know, turntables that are like $500,000. I think the vinyl costs like $2 to make. Imagine that. Like a dollar piece of vinyl on a $1 million turntable. Makes no sense, and it can get crazy, but I do understand it. I do understand people have hobbies and addictions. And I can relate to it. I like to find myself somewhere in between. I've always been a huge Macintosh guy. But recently I found out about Manley Labs. And there's all these boutique companies out there that are making stuff by hand in America that are next level. It's like Rolex watches. People think they're expensive, but when you get into watches, you go, oh, these are just the entry level. And then you start finding out about other watches. It's the same with audio gear. It was a great to have her on. She's been building this stuff by hand in Chino, California for years. And it was just fascinating to talk to her about hi-fi amplifiers, tube amps, and tube microphones, like all your favorite records, you know. Those famous records where a lot of people sang out of tube mics. Tube mics are just the ultimate for warm vocal tone and also any kind of stuff that you're micing up, like guitar amps and everything, but mostly a vocal mic, a good tube a good tube vocal mic will just knock you out. Anyway, I know you guys all love vinyl. I always get the emails, and you love audio equipment. So this is a great episode to have, and another great handmade episode, and perfect on this Memorial Day weekend, because this Memorial Day weekend marks the 35th anniversary of the US Festival. So speaking of music, the US Festival, I've talked about it time and time again on this podcast, and it completely shaped my my love of music. If you look at the lineup, imagine 35 years ago, you're out in San Bernardino. I had no idea where the fuck we were going. My mom rented some, I think it was a Toyota Dolphin or Chinook, one of those weird Toyota trucks with a built-in trailer. It was like a poor man's Airstream. And we headed out to no man's land, and we went to go see the US Festival. And to this day, I think it's the most underrated festival of all time. Of course, you've heard me say that. I'll go through the lineup one more time, and it'll probably be a while since I talk about this again. But this is monumental, man. It's 35 years. And, you know, you always hear about Woodstock. You hear about Coachella. You hear about Live Aid. All these different big things over the years that have happened with music. But you never really hear about the US Festival, which is just crazy to me, man. Steve Wozniak, the Apple computer guy who was part of Apple with Steve Jobs back in the day. He put on the festival. He did it 2 years and then never did it again. It's insane. And you know, the what do you call that thing? The Cal Jam which is interesting because that's Dave Grohl's festival. He took on that name, Cal Jam, from the famous 70s Cal Jam Southern California Festival. But he took that name and he hosts it in the area where the US Festival was. So it's kind of a hybrid of US Festival, Cal Jam, Salute, sort of speak. I do talk about the US Festival and Day on the Green over and over and over because it was where I got to see all these bands and really it, like I said, molded my music taste. A lot of people just went for the metal day, which was day two, but I went all 3 days because I was a fan of numerous bands on numerous days. One of those bands, of course, being The Clash. It was Mick Jones' last appearance with The Clash on day one, which they called the New Wave Day, which is hilarious. New Wave was big at the time. Of course, The Clash is not New Wave. I can't even categorize The Clash. They're ska, they're reggae, they're punk, they're rock, they're rockabilly sometimes. Those guys were so fucking original. But here's the lineup day one, Divinyls. And this is another thing. All these bands, compared to like the festivals now where bands play and years later, I can't even tell you where they went or who they were, you know, like at Coachella. I've got a wall of, I did have a wall of CDs that were Coachella bands that, you know, ooh, these guys are great. After Coachella, I'd buy the CD and then a year later, never hear about them again. That didn't happen back at the US Festival. All these bands had numerous hit songs, which was incredible. They also, a lot of them play to this day, 35 years later. Divinyls was the opening band on day one, New Wave. Berlin, INXS, Wall of Voodoo, which I absolutely love. Stan Ridgway's last gig with Wall of Voodoo was at the US Festival. Something in the water out there. People were ready to quit their bands. Oingo Boingo, The English Beat, Flock of Seagulls, Stray Cats, Men at Work, and The Clash. Another great thing as I look at the lineup is a lot of these people I've had on my podcast, which is just a mind fucking blower there too, to think about in 83, I'm out in the desert watching these bands with over 350 or 1 million people, whatever the number seems to be all the time when you read about it. But to be thinking back then, one day I'm going to talk to Nikki Sixx, you know, or fucking anyone that played the US Festival is a mind blower. I forgot where I was, but Flock of Seagulls, Stray Cats, Men at Work, The Clash. So that was day one. Day two, of course, was the Quiet Riot. It was the metal day. Quiet Riot, Motley Crue, Ozzy, Judas Priest, Triumph, Scorpions, Van Halen. I'm not a big Triumph guy. I never really much talk about them because I'm not a big fan. I don't hate them, and I don't love them. I just, when they come on, I'm just like, oh yeah, Triumph. There's a million bands that could have fit into that slot on the heavy metal day. Triumph, I don't think of them as heavy metal at all, and I don't like to categorize bands anyway, but if you're looking at the lineup, you're going like, which one doesn't belong? It's like when Ozzy's Boneyard on XM, Sirius XM, they play a lot of Billy Squire. I love Billy Squire, big time. Saw him live a few times. The guy fucking murders it. But on the Boneyard, fuck no, he doesn't belong. You don't listen to Metallica, Trapped Under Ice, and then go into the Stroke. I do at home personally. I'm just saying in a format, something's weird there. The third day, which was Monday, which is today, was Los Lobos, who I absolutely worship still to this day. And Los Lobos is one of the most underrated, greatest bands ever to come out. And if you don't have any of Los Lobos records, immediately get any of them. Just try them out. But I'll tell you the ones I love. I love Colossal Head, which is a really rad record. I listened to that thing for about a year for a little bit, man. Just getting, I'll go down a band's rabbit hole and stick with them for a long time. Good morning. How do you say this? I got this record. I love it. As it ran, my favorite is This Time. It's kind of a mellow, cool record, and the song This Time is just fire. Anyway, Los Lobos played Little Steven from Bruce's band and the Disciples of Soul. Quarter Flash, saw him open for Sammy Hagar also on the Standing Hampton tour at the Cow Palace. My brain's working pretty fucking good today. Not sure why. But Quarter Flash had a big, big hit. Got a heart in my heart. Missing Persons, of course, Dale Bozzio out there. Nobody Walks in L.A. And her incredible husband, the king of drums, Terry Bozzio, who, of course, played with Zappa and would be a dream guest on this podcast. I have met his son a few times through Joey Diaz. Great guy. Missing Persons, a very, very unique band at that time. Just super musicians murdering it with an incredible, incredible singer. It was straight up cool art rock. And that was a great time. U2, early on. U2, I've seen U2 many, many times. Always murder it. And I talk U2 a lot. And U2 out there in the desert. Here's one of the highlights of that day to me. The Pretenders, who I absolutely love and think are so underrated. The Pretenders. I've talked about them many times. Joe Walsh. Joe Walsh was supposed to be on the Metal Day, and he was dating Stevie Nicks at the time, from what I read, and demanded to be on the same day, so that's how Quiet Riot got on the Metal Day bill. Joe Walsh, Stevie Nicks, David Bowie. David Bowie absolutely melted the desert down, and it was his first show in 5 years, so everybody was fired up, and he had the amazing record Let's Dance, and that tour became a monster, and that record became a monster, and Bowie was bigger than ever. And I didn't know this until the documentary I saw recently, but Bowie was afraid to fly. So up until 83, he'd only do key states that he could kind of bus around in, and he would boat over from London. And it was not much touring for years, you know, just sporadic cool cities. But in 83, he got over his fear of flying somehow. And he toured the shit out of that record. I saw him twice on this tour, once at the Oakland Coliseum, Dan the Green. He sold out the A's ballpark. 60,000 people out there. China Girl, Let's Dance, Modern Love. A masterpiece record that, of course, we all know Stevie Ray Vaughan played on, but Nile Rodgers, you know, that's his masterpiece with Bowie, and I fucking love this record. So that was the weekend, and then they had a country weekend, which was the following Saturday. Now that I look at the bill, I wish I was there. But young, you'd be like, country, fuck that. You know, it was Hank Williams Jr., Emmylou Harris, Alabama, Waylon Jennings, Writers in the Sky, and Willie Nelson. So you can see the format, of course. Coachella taking that on later, having their country weekend the following weekend called Stagecoach. And, of course, Coachella also having their own metal thing, the Big Four, and all that. So the influence is there. There needs to be the documentary. I hope one day to make it. And that's a dream. I'm in New York City right now, and I hope to see you guys. I'm at the Stand pretty much every night until June 10th. And then I just got dealt another sock to the chest. another challenge in life, another hurdle. Another hurdle, another challenge. I accept. Anyway, I've come out for the month. to do comedy and found out that the Stand is moving and closing on June 10th, and they won't be back open for a few months at least. So here I am in New York like, oh, wow. It's always something, man. It's always something, and I feel like there's small tests to see if you'll tap out. And no, I won't tap out. I'll take the challenge. I love New York City, and I've been having some great sets, and I've met some amazing Del Razors, some Grateful Deans at the shows, and it's just been pretty amazing. That's it for now. Upcoming shows, just so you want to know, just so you want to know, just because I want you to know, because I want you to be there. May, what do I got here? Sorry, June 7th. I will be headlining one night in Boston at Nick's Comedy Stop. That is June 7th, next week. Vegas Comedy Cellar, June 28th through June 30th. Those are the two road shows coming up. Oh, and what else I got? Oh, that's it right now. Anyway, and then hopefully I'll be at the Comedy Cellar in New York here in June, most of June, I hope. If not, I'll just find shows to do and just pound the ground. Pound the ground. It's been great, great time out here in New York so far. Tons of New York people out. Got to see friends all over town. I somehow magically that happens. Ian Edwards is here, one of my greatest friends, and he's writing on Crashing. Judd Apatow is here. Pete Holmes is here. Fahim Anwar is here, shooting his show, Goatface. You know, and if you're not watching Crashing, get with this. Everything Apatow does is fucking gold. I mean, it's all quality, man. It's all great, high watermark stuff. So watch Crashing, Pete Holmes and Judd Apatow's Crashing. Okay. That's about it right now. I love all you guys. Keep the candles lit. Enjoy this handmade episode. Put on a record and fire up the barbecue and salute those soldiers that give us the freedom and protect us out there and all their families, everybody that has lost somebody in wartime. Give them the love out there, man. It doesn't matter what your political thoughts are or whatever. These soldiers are amazing. And we got to salute them. We got to salute them, those about to rock, you know? Okay, here we go. Let's get with it. Little handmade, Manly Labs. Check out their website, too, while I'm talking to her, because then you can see what we're looking at and stuff. Candles lit. All right, here we are. Another episode of Let There Be Talk. Fantastic. This is going to be a handmade episode. Introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Ivana Manley from Manly Labs.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, where the hell did we meet?
No, we didn't meet. Somebody somebody said, hey, this would probably be a good guest because I have these handmade episodes on. And then I love audio stuff, you know. So they were like, check this out. And then I started looking. I go, oh, my friend Tim follows you. And I think he has one of your mics.
Okay, good.
So then Tim from the Mother Hips. So then I was like, and then I got on the website and I was like, well, this shit's rad, you know. And I was like, oh, this would be a perfect guest. So you brought this Manly Stingray iTube. This thing is nuts. Now, if you're listening to the episode right now, go onto the website while we're talking, and then we can describe stuff. Manly.com. But how did you guys start, and well, what is your background?
That's M-A-N-L-E-Y, just to make sure that we're just not talking about being all manly.
Oh, stuff. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
not an adverb.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, manly.
Manly.
This and shit like, is manly.
And I like it, too. It's a proper noun. I started in the late 80s. I was in college. I was studying music, and I was in New York City, and it was just all cold and snowy and slushy, and It would be like, I would get all depressed and like not even see the daylight. I would just sleep all day and then work all night. And
yeah. In the studio?
Classes.
Or
no,
or
I was going
school.
To college.
Oh,
yeah.
What school?
So, Columbia.
Oh, right on.
And I, you know, I was just kind of getting depressed, actually, honestly, yeah. in the winter. And you know, all my music collection and movies and, you know, everything was like calling me out to California. Like, I wanted to come out to where all this creativity is,
yeah,
and the sunshine and all this. And so I, at New Year's, I got in my Volkswagen Bug and I drove across the country by myself. I was like 19 or 20 years old.
Wow. Were you like a hippie?
No.
No?
No.
Were you had
nerd.
A Volkswagen
nerd.
Bug? Nerd.
Like a poor nerd.
Just a college
someone
nerd.
Someone had given me that car. So family I lived with in Atlanta gave me that car. So, I mean, I was just a poor geeky nerd going to school.
Right.
Music. Yeah, so I came out here, and, you know, my stepdad, he owned Ampeg in the 60s.
He did?
He did.
Whoa, he
and
owned
so
Ampeg?
He did. He bought it from...
During the SVT, like the
exactly.
like the ground zero. I mean,
yeah,
that is
it,
the base rig.
He bought it in 66 from the founder, Everett Hall.
Wow.
And the original Ampeg stood for amplified peg of the upright bass, you know, the foot of the upright bass.
Oh, yeah, that thing that slides out.
Yeah, so that was his first invention, I suppose.
That was amplified. That was like a microphone for the, pickup for the bass?
Yeah, but wow. In the peg or something. Well, I don't even know. But anyway, but my dad bought it with some investors in 1966, and then I think the SVT, they worked on that, and came out when, in 68 or something like that, 67? 68, 69.
And what city was that company?
That was in New Jersey.
Oh, Jersey.
Yeah. In fact, years later, when I met Les Paul.
Yeah.
And I knew Les Paul was in New Jersey. I asked him, I said, did you know my dad, Al DeRay? And he says, oh, yes. Your father bought Ampeg in my living room.
Wow. And
I'm like, of course he did, because everything originated from Les Paul's living room.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You know,
the entire rock and roll history.
Yeah,
multi-track
so,
recording, Les Paul's, SG's,
amazing.
Everything.
Yeah, he was a cool dude, man.
So crazy.
So yeah, going back to 1989, I'm out here, and my dad gave me a couple names of some guys that had worked for him 20 years prior, and I called the first guy, and he didn't pick up the phone.
Yeah.
I mean, this is before iPhones and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, and, answer machine.
Yeah.
Cassette tape.
So then I called the second name on the list, and that guy was Roger Cox at Fender. And I was thinking, oh, I'll get a job like sanding guitars or something.
Were you into music?
Whatever.
Did you play music?
Yeah, yeah. I was studying music.
Oh, well, I know, but did you?
I played saxophones.
Oh, wow.
And, clarinet and a little trumpet. But I was studying music theory and history. Like, I would have been qualified to be a band director or something.
Oh, I gotcha.
I didn't really want to teach. But anyway, yeah, so Roger picked up the phone, and I actually applied to Fender, but he called me back, like, later in the week. He said, you should call these two crazy South Africans out in Chino building tube amps. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
Yeah.
What?
Tube amps.
Sounds weird.
Yeah, guitar amps?
I knew that tubes were good.
Yeah.
You know, from dad telling us that, you know, the SVTs and there was solid state didn't sound as good as tubes. So I had been brainwashed at an early age.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so I went out to meet David Manley and Luke Manley at a company called Vacuum Tube Logic of America. And I walked in and there were these tube hi-fi amplifiers all over the place, but
like Macintosh kind of stuff.
Yeah, but yeah, with the tubes all
like the
exposed,
monoblocks, yeah,
you know. And I just knew a tube amp, like a receiver that looks like your
right.
Grant's there. My parents had a Fisher 500C growing up, you know, so I was looking at these things with the tubes all poking out, and I'm like, what are these things? And they're like, oh, they're vacuum tube monoblocks.
Yeah. And you're like, where is the covers? I always thought that when I was young. Where's the covers?
It's like you play whack-a-mole with these things, you know.
Yeah.
But that's how green I was. I didn't know anything about anything at all. So they saw I was bright enough to sit in a chair and solder up, you know, learn to solder up some printed circuit boards. So that was my first job.
So you're out here and you're just huffing solder?
Yeah, I was huffing solder and soldering boards, and the Mexicans on the line were teaching me, how to solder. I didn't know how to solder.
Yeah.
I didn't even know how to speak Spanish. I took French.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's the wrong language. So when I went back to school in September of 89, the last class I took at Columbia was Spanish class.
Right.
I took the wrong language to live in California.
Were they successful, these guys? Because, yeah. Of course, in the world of 70s and 80s, and even in the world now, Macintosh being the king. But as you start to dig into high-end stereo stuff like I have over the years, you realize it's a lot like Rolex. That's people know that brand, but there's stuff way beyond it. And you know what I mean? Mm. So what was that company? Were they just kind of a mom and pop kind of monoblock building thing?
Pretty much. I mean, back in the 1980s, vacuum tube anythings in the audio world, not talking about guitar amplifiers,
right?
Because guitar amps, tube amps have always been the king in the guitar world. So, but in the hi-fi world and the professional audio studio world, tubes were all but dead.
Yeah.
So like in the studio world in the 80s, you had Tube Tech and Summit, basically,
right,
as the two companies just still hanging on. And they were small mom-and-pop operations as well. And then in the hi-fi arena, along comes this crazy British guy from South Africa, David Manley, who wrote a little book, a propaganda book called the VTL book,
and right,
telling everyone that tubes are the way to go.
And well, I mean,
he had to create this... That tubes were really dead in the audiophile world.
I never really thought tubes went away because, of course, you had Neumann mics and everybody was into Neumann in the studio world, and now even crazier this stuff. But even in the 80s, you know, you'd be like, well, what's the studio got? And they go, well, they got a Neve and they got some Neumanns. You're like, oh, fuck, we're in there, you know?
Yeah, but they were older mics too. Like the current production of the time was really waning in the 80s.
Yeah.
Tubes were not super popular. So David Manley kind of led, because he was a very outgoing and outspoken person, he really led this campaign to bring tubes back into the mainstream.
Right.
And he was a large part of what they call the modern tube renaissance that took place. And then after that, in the early 90s, you had, in the hi-fi world, you had companies like Carry Audio, Sonic Frontiers, you remember them?
Yep.
Audio Research was still going. Audio Research and Conrad Johnson and Macintosh were still building tube gear in the 80s. You know?
Right.
But then this whole flood of all the single-ended stuff and all this real love for tube gear really came back in the 90s in a big way.
Yeah, because even Mac switched to boards and stuff like this. You know, like somebody will send over to me, hey, look at this one here, this Mac receiver here. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's not the tube one. Yeah. And the solid state ones are still good. That Marantz right there is solid state.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it looks tube. It was,
looks the bomb.
Yeah, well, that thing is the bomb because it was to go against Macintosh back in the day.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the blue collar version of it. So if you're a blue collar, you got the Marantz. And if you had some next, doctor money, you had the Macintosh. You know,
got it.
But there is, of course, there are stuff that are solid state that are great, but at the end of the day, I think most people can't hear the difference, but it's all about quality, you know what I mean? And that's why I love handmade stuff. You know, I can hear the difference, and I know a lot of people want the tubes. And they want a great set of speakers and a killer turntable. They're always hitting me up like, what should I get, you know? And tubes are, when it comes to guitar amps and studio stuff, it's absolutely a must, you know?
Yeah, but power amps in the house, man, it's like there's a humanity to it or something. There's a feeling you get from really great tube gear. I'm not talking about crummy, cheap tube gear, but when you do it really right with really excellent output transformers and a great circuit, nice quiet circuit and all. I don't know. There's some kind of meaty, generous, delicious feeling about tube amps that I hear anyway.
Absolutely. I do too.
Yeah.
What is the What is the style of monoblock? Because if you're getting a Macintosh, you can just get a 275. It's two of them in one. But if you're running two monoblocks, it's two separate amps. Is it one amp per speaker? Is that what it's doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And then you have a whole dedicated power supply for that channel.
Right.
And the two channels don't really interface or interact with each other. They're treated separately. So all their resources are dedicated for that.
Right, right.
So that's ultimately the best way to go for the, you know, impeccable stereo separation and all that kind of thing.
Right, right.
When you have a stereo integrated amplifier like I brought here today with this Manly Stingray, that's got a shared power transformer here.
Right, one power transformer.
And then...
what are the two, one on the left and one on the right?
These are output transformers.
Yeah, gotcha.
And then these are the filtration capacitors in the power supply caps. For each channel. So... sometimes you'll have two sets of, you'll have two secondaries, you know, it depends how we do the transformers. It's possible to have two sets of secondaries off the power transformer that are driving two separate bridge rectifiers and then all the filtration and all that. So the only common thing they're sharing is the core of the power transformer.
Are you hand wiring, winding your own power transformers? Or are you
not
buying them?
The power transformers? Those are made by a company up in Willits, California.
Willits, NCI. NorCal.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Skunk Train.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I get. Okay.
There's a train up there called the Skunk Train. You can ride it through the woods. You know.
Right. Well, hopefully, it stays on the tracks.
Yeah.
Unlike that other train on the coast.
Now. So
yeah, the output transformers that the audio is passing through from the tube's anodes to the loudspeaker.
Right.
Output transformers, those we make in Chino, California.
So this is left and this is right.
Well, it could depend on.
Well, yeah, whatever.
And it doesn't care.
I mean, this thing is fucking.
It's on your left side or your right side.
This thing is for, is this like for an iPod?
Yeah, this is an older one back. I guess about 15 years ago or so, I think I was the first one to do a tube integrated amplifier with an iPod dock.
Right.
And so it charges your iPod. You might have a bunch of playlists in your iPod and you plugged it in and it was its own little source. This also has three other sets of RCA, stereo RCA inputs as well.
For gear like turntables and stuff.
Yeah, for your...
But this is nuts, like this
but
whole
it was
thing
cool.
for...
At the time, it was cool. But then after... And then, you know, like the iPhones became popular. And I mean, I stopped using my iPod after I could put it on my iPhone and I would not carry two little books with me.
They don't even make the
iTouch or something.
Yeah, they don't even make any of
that. They're not even going to you can't even download stuff anymore coming soon.
I read that.
It's all going to be streaming. So.
It's crazy, man. It's
I'm a lazy audiophile these days.
Yeah.
And I have a bunch of Sonos systems around my house. And some of them are hooked up to tube amps and some aren't. And I mean, the radio that's in the kitchen probably gets the most use in my house. It's just always playing songs. It's always playing music. It's always streaming.
Well, I think there's two styles of listening. There's listening to just get the voices out of your head, like, you know, walking and talking and traveling and everything. And then there's like what I do every day here is I throw on a record and I listen to the record all the way through.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Active versus passive, huh?
Right. Well, yeah. I think it takes the ADD out of listening and you sit down and you go, oh, here's some old shit right here of sequencing and a cover. And I got to get up. I got to turn it over. And I also chose that record so I can't just pop up and just play another song from another band. And it really draws me back in. And also, 100%, the sound is just fantastic.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, also, you're lucky you've got the space where you've got your record collection out. And
right.
I remember when I had massive shelving in my old house and I could listen to the record and my eyes would wander along the record, the spines of the albums. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I want to play that Rolling Stones record next.
Yeah.
You know, but it's harder when you're playing from stuff in the cloud because you don't have that visual.
Of course.
In the same way. And it freaks me out. Sometimes when I'm trying to decide what to listen to, I visually imagine my old living room and how my CDs and records were arranged. And it's like, oh, yeah, the white one with the red letters. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was a Columbia label. Yeah, what was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to play that one.
Yeah.
And but now when I'm just trying to pick something from Spotify or Tidal or whatever, it's hard to imagine what to listen to sometimes. So I don't do as much active listening like you talk about.
Yeah, you got it. It's funny because
I just put on like French radio station FIP.
Yeah.
C'est le FIP. And just they have like rock station and world music stations and French radio stations. That just let them play me some new stuff I've never heard before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's always adventurous too.
Yeah, but I don't have the right kind of space to have a nice listening room in the house I live in right now.
It's hilarious because you make great stuff and you're not even used it yet.
I know.
Oh my God.
Well, the living room in my new house, it doesn't sound good. I've had several different sets of speakers in there.
Yeah.
And the floor is over a crawl space, so it's not a solid floor.
Oh, so you get some feedback?
No, it's just kind of bouncy in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just, I don't know, man, it just doesn't sound that good in there. So I don't want to listen to crummy audiophile system.
Yeah.
So I took all that stuff out of there. My buddy gave me a piano. I put all my saxophones out on stands. And my girlfriend's got guitars and bass and a drum kit. And there's just all instruments in there now.
Right.
And that's even
That's cool,
fun.
Too.
So people come over, we can jam on some instruments or just... You know, sometimes I'll just pick up a trumpet and blow a couple notes and just make my dog bark at me.
How do you get involved with Manly?
Oh, right. So back in those days in 1989, so I was working for David Manly and his son Luke. And then David and I ended up dating and we got married, actually, right. the next year after that.
Right.
And so we were married for a couple years and then... He had some personal issues and some, he was fighting some demons and he was going a little crazy with manic depression and alcoholism. And
yeah.
So by 96, he moved to France. He took off.
Wow.
He fled. He fled the country. He fled the world. He's no longer alive at this moment. But so it was kind of hard because I was super young at the time. I wasn't even 30 years old.
Right.
I was in my late 20s and... It's like, well, I guess I could go back to Atlanta. I've got friends there, or I could go do something else. Or I actually had an invitation from a guitar amplifier company to go manage their production line.
Wow, who was it?
It was Mesa Boogie.
Oh, Mesa Boogie. Yeah. Love them up
so
there.
They,
Petaluma.
They were talking to me. So I had
a lot of this stuff looks like a boogie kind of. It's like a triple rectifier. You know what I mean?
It's all good tube gear. So I had some options, you know, and David Manly we had this record label going and he had all this recording equipment and pianos and studio tape machines and just, there's so much stuff. And it's like, you know, if you want to liquefy all these assets, I'll sell all this stuff off for you and we'll construct a deal in the divorce and I'll buy you out of the company and basically cash you out of America.
Right.
And he didn't like that idea at first. And it's like, well, or I'll just, you know, fuck off and go back to Atlanta and good luck.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So the better deal for him was definitely to enlist my help. And so that's kind of how it went down, basically. So I cashed him out of America, basically.
Oh, I got you. So you just took his part, all his stuff from the company?
I sold all the stuff that he had amassed,
you know, yeah.
Cars and boats and scooters and just stuff. There was just so many things and recording equipment and all this and, you know, got all the money out to him. And it was his way to monetize his time in America, basically.
Right.
Right. So, cause
and then you became the owner?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So and
I paid him out.
Were you like, oh man, I own a company now, and like, did you start to think of a vision of like, what do we want to build? Were they building microphones back then?
Yeah, we were building. By this time in '93 is when Manly Lab separated apart from VTL.
Yeah,
and so we took with us to the new building all the pro audio equipment and half the staff. We kind of split up the companies at that time. And then Yeah, 96 and David left. I was running the company by that time anyway, you know, managing production and helping get products into production. You know, he would do a prototype and it would basically work, but it needed some massaging to get all the bugs worked out and all
right.
That was one of my primary jobs in the early 90s was to get really like everything.
Like R&D and the stuff?
Yeah, everything would be humming and making noise or this control wouldn't work right or something and I'd have to kind of hunt it down and figure it out. And
how are you learning that shit? Are you just doing it all by...
just on the bench and figuring it out.
Really. Wow.
Because David would say like, oh, it's fine, just ship it. And I'm like, well, no, actually, I just got a call from a customer about how noisy that other thing is, and this thing's even noisier. We can't ship it like this. You know, he's like, oh, it's fine.
Oh.
They don't know what they're talking about. I'm like, yeah, they're the ones buying the gear.
Yeah, and it's audio gear. Like,
it's not going to happen. So, and some of our customers would come out to Chino and bring their thing they just bought and like, hey, is this working right? I'm like, here, give it to me. Let's look at this. And
right.
Because at the time, dude, honestly, I mean, I didn't even know what a limiter was or a compressor, you know. It's like, okay, mathematically, I know you put this level in, and then when you reach this, you're only going to get that level out, and it's reducing by this ratio. Okay, I can draw that out. I can see what it, but what would you use that for? Like, I wasn't a recording engineer. I had no idea. Like,
right.
Okay, well, you don't want to hit overs on your converters and stuff. That makes sense, but why do you actually just use it, you know?
Yeah, I get it. Like, what is this shit for in the studio?
Because
it's
not innate, like, this stuff.
They're using it to warm up the sound of recording, right?
Yeah, but there was still a lot of
like, tape. Like, two preamps?
Sure, but there was still a lot of tape being used back then in the right. early 90s, too. That was the transition time. Where it was moving, you know, from
Pro Tools is kind of new.
Yeah. Sonic Solutions on the mastering end was a computerized editing system that was very popular back then. And then you had ADATs.
ADATs, the worst.
That stuff.
Remember those?
The Dash machines?
Yeah. ADATs were so weird, though, because if you were running, there was a four track. And then if you're running another four track and another one and you're doing a punch, you had to wait till they all linked up. So you punched and it was like one would start up, then the other one would start up, and then you'd miss the fucking punch because you'd go, oh, the track wasn't even playing. God, they were a nightmare. And they sounded horrible. I did a record on ADAT. Whenever I hear it, it's just flat, early ADAT. They eventually got it. There was like an ADAT like Pro later or whatever. And they got better, but man, that was really some early digital recording. Yeah.
And you know, I think about that now, like the popularity of our big stereo limiter, the Variable Mu.
Yeah.
That, it came along at such a good time. So we came out with that in 1994, and that's like when these ADATs and DA88s were taken off, and there starts to be this transition from tape machines to digital. And those early converters just wanted to rip your ears off, right? They didn't sound very good.
Right.
And this big, beefy, manly stereo tube compressor comes out with its transformers, and it just, it does, quote, warm up your sound.
It warmed up that early sound, digital stuff?
Yeah, it made it sound a little more pleasing to the ear, you know? And then, but now, it's like why we came out with a newer unit called the new Mu, which is a solid state transformer, output transformerless unit. And it's because digital converters now are fine.
Yeah.
That's what we all use. That's what they are.
Yeah.
They're way better than they were in the 90s.
And absolutely.
So you don't need to really mask and cover all that stuff anymore. And in fact, with a lot of music today, people don't want to put a big mask on it. They want to let it just come through and breathe.
Right.
So we've designed a newer unit, a limiter, that allows for that. That's not putting this big sonic imprint on the sound, because that's not necessarily what's needed right now.
And who's coming up with new product there? Are you guys just like, what do people want? Do you go to like the NAMM show and ask people, what the hell are you looking for in the studios? And people say, oh, I don't need something to just blow up the warmth anymore. Maybe just something to send it through. And then you start to build something from the ground up?
Yeah, it's basically my job to communicate with users and with people with, I kind of socialize here in LA a lot with a lot of recording engineers and studio guys. And in fact, there's a weekly thing that we meet up for lunch like every week. There's like about 50 of us.
Wow.
In Burbank that we all get together. And it's great to constantly be in the studios and working with the guys and having my ear to the ground. It's like, what are y'all looking for? You know, people say, hey, why don't you guys come out with the so-and-so? Or, hey, do you guys, are you working on a new mic? Or, you know, whatever. And or, and another thing, too, it's like we've got some of our classic products like the VoxBox and Variable Mu and Massive Passive. They're really expensive products, right?
Right.
They're $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 things. And they're expensive to build because at the time in the 90s when they were designed, like we would design them and then we would add up what they cost and then say, well, there's where the retail price is going to be. We weren't ever designing to a price point.
Right, right. Yeah, because you were just building for quality, right?
Yeah, we were just living in the stratosphere of being this super high-end.
High-end audio.
All right. But there's a whole new class of people that have come out since then.
Home recorders, right?
That's right. So, and then not everyone's got $4,000 to $6,000 to spend on this thing, you know. So
they don't even got $4,000 to $6,000 to spend on their record.
On nothing.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, the whole record doesn't.
The record company's like, you got $5,000, make it at your house, go. And they're like, what? We got a record deal, man. You know what I mean? That's crazy, so, right?
Yeah, so we've learned a couple things about production since those days, and we've been able to come out with newer pieces designed to build faster and build more efficiently, and that's where we come up with the price difference. We don't.
Is it made in Chino still?
Yeah.
Wow.
Made in Chino, not China.
Nice. Yeah, Chino, not China.
I know, and that's another thing is maintaining the integrity of the production like that. And not just trying to, you know, be greedy and just make a bunch of dollars by making it cheaper and charging the same amount. So we engineered these newer products like the Manly Core is, you know, it's half the price of the VoxBox. And it does like the same thing. It's
like
pre-EQ, compressor, and limiter.
So it's for people using Pro Tools.
Yeah.
So
track all day long.
Track all day and it just makes it sound great.
Yeah, because it's got... You know, it's got a tube mic pre.
Right.
It's got an awesome compressor, an electro-optical compressor, like an LA-2A type thing. It's got a Baxandall solid-state EQ, the core does. And then it's got a really fast FET brick wall limiter at the end so you don't get any overs.
Right.
Your ADD. So all you do is just plug your microphone into that thing and you are... That's all you need to record, you know.
Wow. For vocal or for everything, guitar and everything.
Yeah, it's what got if you're, a great DI.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice what DI. If you're plugging just directly in?
Bass or guitar.
Yeah.
Sure.
Wow.
All day. So that's one of our more popular units. But again, it's half the price of the VoxBox,
yeah,
which we designed in 97. But it's because it builds for half the cost.
Right.
And...
When you were building it, did you have a bunch that were not working? Like, oh, this sucks, you know, like as you're getting the prototypes together?
When we prototype stuff?
Yeah.
Well, sure, that happens all the time. And that's why, again, we work with a lot of guys here in LA, and I'll bring a prototype in to a guy and say, hey, listen to this and tell me what you think. And there's been occasion where they're like, oh, yeah, oh, fuck, the bass, what are you doing here? This sounds like a cheap... piece of shit.
Right.
It's like, oh, okay, yeah, we've not hit this right.
Right, yeah.
Go back to Chino. It's like, this is really soggy. Why is this so bad sounding? You know, and again, I'd rather rely on professional listeners that do this every day in their excellent sounding studios, you know, and they're the ones that are going to buy it, not me.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, this is why I don't really need to have...
Plus, their ears can tell right away.
Sure.
It comes on, they go, nah, like right away.
Same here, when I'm in the studio with them, too, it's like, oh, hell. But that's one big advantage being here in LA is to get to interface with all these guys.
Who you work with any big producers or anybody, like Rick Rubin or anybody, where they're like, oh, we got to have some Manly stuff in here? Anybody?
Yeah, Rick's a customer of ours. He's not a guy I beta test with.
Yeah, he's a
buddy and he's a customer. And Rick's a really wonderful person. Rick Rick has been great help to me in my life. He really inspired me. I saw him several years ago at CES show. He's a big time audiophile as well.
I've been to his house up there behind, off the Sunset Strip.
Yeah.
And he had that listening room.
He had Manly Gear in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So, and now he's got a bunch of Sonos players at his Malibu house. He doesn't have too much real big hi-fi stuff there. Anyway, I saw Rick, and he had lost like half his body weight.
Yeah.
You know, because he was a big guy.
He was huge, and all of a sudden he was this yoga guy and looked fantastic.
And he walked in the room, because we used to have a date to like go hang out once a year at the Consumer Electronics Show. And we'd go walk around and look at the hi-fi gear and then go get some dinner or something. But the first time I hung out with him, I was with another buddy of mine, and it's like, Rick Rubin said, yeah, let's go. There's a new club at the Palms. So, all right, we'll go there. We'll meet you there. So he went in his limo, and I went in my station wagon and with my other buddy.
Yeah.
And we rock up, and there's this big line at this club, and me and my other buddy walked in because we were kind of dressed for the show, for the trade show, and Rick Rubin has his white T-shirt on, and the doorman just puts his arm out in front of him and says, dress code.
Yeah, dress code.
And
yeah.
We look behind us. We're like, damn, that's Rick Rubin. They're not letting Rick Rubin in. What the hell?
He's got thongs on. You know, shorts. Yeah.
And the bouncer wouldn't let him in. And I'm like, Rick, get the jacket off your limo driver or something. And he's like, nah, don't worry about it. And so we flew that coupe. And we're all in Rick's limo driving down the strip in Las Vegas. And I'm looking at my other buddy. I'm like, what the hell are we going to do with Rick Rubin in Las Vegas? I mean, he's Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
And he's vegetarian. And he doesn't eat sushi. And he doesn't drink. And he doesn't smoke. And doesn't do drugs. And it's like...
sleep.
It's like, what are we going to do with Rick? So we ended up just going down to the Luxor and drinking water at a bar, you know. And this is kind of a cool story. So... the topic of conversation with the three of us was like, who's your favorite singer-songwriter? So I think Rick said John Lennon. We talked about John Lennon for a while. And then the other buddy Rick, he's like Neil Young. And we talked about Neil Young for a while. And I said, all right, you boys, don't laugh at me. But I mean, you took some really good ones already. But I think we need to give some credit to Neil Diamond here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's been doing this for decades, and look at this great body of work and all these wonderful songs he's done. He's still at it, and it's like Neil Diamond, he's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And then like a month later, Rick's assistant called me up and said, do you have Neil Diamond's contact? And I'm like, well, I've got his engineer's contact. Here's Bernie's contact.
Yeah.
And then he ended up making two records with him.
That's wild, right?
And I was like, and they're half great. Based on just like that
conversation,
hanging out with him, you know, it's kind of cool.
That's so awesome.
I haven't met Neil Diamond yet, but I hope to meet him sometime and be able to tell him the story, how, you know, I might have had a small influence on his life.
Yeah.
He doesn't even know about.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of cool.
Let's talk about this microphone a little bit here. You only make one microphone?
We make three different microphones.
You make three different ones.
That's the Manly Reference Gold mic.
And that one kind of looks like, you know, like the classic studio tube mic, right?
Well, it is a classic studio
exactly.
tube mic. That's a multi-pattern mic. That capsule was made in America by David Josephson. It's kind of like a C12 style capsule.
Right.
That's that kind of thing. The other mic we make is the Manly Reference cardioid mic. It looks like that, but it's black and red. And that's actually our best-selling thing that we make.
Wow, really?
And we sell hundreds and hundreds of those a year. And that has become a real super popular vocal mic, like a real big pop mic, like
for
Katy
vocal.
Perry and Acacia and all.
Why is
people.
It kind of a compressy sound? And here it is right here.
Well, I don't know, man. There's something magical about the whole thing. That capsule is more a Neumann style capsule with a center fixed
of course.
In the middle. It's cardioid only, and it's just got this really great sound when you talk or sing into it. No matter how much processing you put after it, it just cuts through. Wow. And that was Don LaFontaine's mic, the voice of God.
Oh, yeah.
In a world.
Yeah, yeah.
That guy. The voice of God was a Manly Reference cardioid mic and a Manly mic pre.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
How much is that mic?
$3,000 retail.
$3,000.
And then the new puppy we're making
and
there.
And then middle here?
Is this silver microphone. And that has another David Josephson capsule made in California. And that capsule is pretty much like a Sony C37.
Oh, wow.
And it's got a mechanical vent on the back that you can turn to change from Omni to cardioid.
Oh, wow.
But it's got a very special sound. It's very rich and creamy. It's got this insane mid-range. It's really warm and delicious.
That's amazing.
It's got a lot of character.
How about some of this mastering stuff here? This is just like if you're mastering your record, you're just running it through these. Are these all tubes?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we do mastering version of the Variable Mu, mastering version of the Massive Passive EQ, and then mastering version of the Slam limiters. And we've worked really closely with mastering engineers from day one.
Right.
And we still do.
The amount of stuff you guys make is incredible, you know?
It's nuts.
It really is. And it's all made there in Chino?
Yeah, you come out and see the factory.
Oh, man, absolutely. Now, what? Let's get a little bit into the hi-fi gear, because that is... I don't play music anymore, or else I would be all over this pro audio shit, because it's just incredible. But when I look at some of this stuff... What is this right here, your monobox, equivalent to, like, say, the 275s or the 75s?
Or bigger. I mean, that's
big power.
That's a 10-output tube monster, that 250-watt.
10 outputs? Like, what do you need 10 outputs for? Oh, 10 output tubes. Gotcha. I thought you meant 10 output.
No.
Like, what are you plugging into that?
That'd be quite a surround system.
Yeah, right. I'm like, what are you plugging into that?
So that's it. It's got 10 single-ended amplifiers on one chassis.
So that's 250 watts per channel?
Yeah. So that's 10 EL34s.
Yeah.
So 5+5 push-pull output with a big, giant output transformer. And
who's using that stuff?
No, man, if you've got big speakers that are inefficient, you know, that you need the power and you need to rock out, you know, or you've got a speaker with a very difficult load to drive.
Right.
You just got to muscle through that thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So 75's not even coming close. You got
no.
Right.
We build up to 500 watts.
I saw that.
The biggest guy is with 10 KT90s on the output, and that's 500 watt output.
What kind of people are using that? Like people with mansions or nightclubs or what?
Guys like Rick Rubin. He's got a pair of those 250s.
Oh, does he?
He had them on in his Hollywood house.
Wow.
Again, he's not using that stuff right now. He's downsized. He's got a more beautiful backyard now.
Right. Now, what's that? What do those go for?
They're still pretty reasonably priced compared to, you know, other competition. So, what does it go for? I forgot. $12,000-$14,000 a pair.
Whoa!
It's not that bad, man.
I know. I'm just saying.
I know, and the other thing, it's like everything we build, it's got pretty much the same multiplier from what it costs us to build.
Right, I get you.
To get to the
I'm not knocking
price.
It. I just have no clue. That's why I was asking.
There's a lot of audiophile companies where they just like, oh, yeah, let's multiply times 30,
right.
You know, and that's how you have like $10,000 cables. And
yeah, that shit's like, stupid, right? Let's get into that, like cables.
It's audiophiles, they want to be punished is what I think sometimes. And we come at them with like complete honesty and like a reasonably priced thing, and it's not expensive enough.
I know, because like if you that's how audiophile people are. They go, well, that cable's only $200. It's got to be shit.
Yeah.
And they're going like, it's a cable, man. You can only go like, I mean, back in the day, I remember Monster Cable was the cable, you know, like, and now Monster Cable is considered just garbage. You know what I'm saying?
It's Kmart cable.
Yeah, right.
It's not expensive enough.
Right. Now cable's like, these cables made out of 18 karat gold with the input channel, you know, it's like, it really is a fierce rabbit hole. What would somebody get into if they were looking like, you know, say those Macintosh style 75 per channel? Do you make that kind of stuff?
Yeah, like
smaller.
Let's talk about the Manly Snapper.
All right,
that's a 100-watt monoblock.
And would you run two of these side by side?
Yeah. One for left and one for right.
Those are badass looking.
They're cool.
The spaceship legs. I really
the same
like
that. These. Yeah, they're all machine.
And this would just be like, so you'd plug these one
that's
on 100 the left.
Watts. It's four EL34 output tubes
right.
per chassis. And that'll drive most anything you can put at it, you know.
So you run one on the left, one on the right, and then in the middle you'd have your receiver and preamp. Like
you'd have your
like,
preamplifier, yeah.
Right, like and a C-22. I love that Macintosh
yeah.
C-22.
Yeah,
you know?
or we built some other preamps as well.
You do?
Our most popular hi-fi products these days have been our phono stages.
Let's see. Oh, here.
Yeah, so our big guy here, that's called the Steelhead.
Yeah.
That came out in the early 2000s, and it was one of the first. I don't know if it was the first. It might have been. But you know how you have to set your loading for your cartridge?
Right.
You have to set your resistive loading and your capacitive loading.
Yeah, yeah.
For a moving magnet cartridge, at least. In the past, preamplifiers, it's always been very cumbersome to actually set those up. Like, usually you take the top off the preamp, or you're in the back of the unit with dip switches or something and trying to set it up. And you can't actually hear what you're affecting, the change you're affecting while you're switching it, because you're in the gear.
You're not sitting at your chair
or whatever. So that Steelhead, we brought all those controls out onto knobs on the faceplate. And it was one of the first units where you could sit there and adjust those loading characteristics, and you're not going to like damage anything, and you're not going to blow anything up,
right?
And you can adjust the loading, and you can hear like the difference of the sound. So
that preamplifier is all for the cartridge.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Super flexible though. It has one line input and a volume control, so you can run like the output from another preamplifier into it. You know, like,
yeah, gotcha.
You know, with several other, or some kind of switch or something like that.
Well,
and that's because I was thinking, because at the time and now, the D to A converters, their outputs are hot, and they'll drive your power amps just fine. You know,
right.
You don't need any more gain in your preamp. You actually just need attenuation. So this kind of turned a lot of thinking on its head.
Hey, can you, now let's say you didn't want to run a receiver. Would you just run the two monoblocks and then this here and plug your turntable into that?
Yeah. A receiver, don't forget, is a preamplifier with power amp built in.
Right.
You know, like like your Marantz or a lot of the, you know, Japanese receivers.
Yeah, yeah, like those old 70s
Pioneers
ones.
And Harman Kardons and all that. So in this world, the audiophile world, you usually don't see receivers. You usually don't see like a tuner and a preamplifier and a power amplifier all built in together.
Right.
So they're all separate. So we have separate phono stages, separate line stages, and separate power amplifiers.
Wow.
Sometimes we have a preamp and a power amp that's in one chassis, like the Steelhead. I mean, like the Stingray.
So you could... technically, like, I could get rid of this Marantz. I'm not going to, but let's just say, and just have this and your two monoblocks and be rocking the turntable?
Absolutely.
Whoa, that's so clean.
Yeah.
Right? Because I love this Marantz because it's part of my soul of growing up in the 70s. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you really wanted a clean system where, because I never, ever used the tuner. And I don't use anything on there. I don't have a CD player. I don't have a cassette player.
Records, yeah.
It's just records. So mm-hmm. just be the turntable, mm-hmm. this Manly, this thing right here, the Steelhead, and then the two monoblocks.
Yeah, that's all you need.
Wow.
Well, and your $10,000 cables, right?
Oh, well, yeah. Wow, that's crazy shit, man, because, you know, I think a lot of people, when they look at high-end audio. They just don't know what they're even looking at. They just heard this is what you should get, and they don't even know what they're buying. What do these pieces do? What are these components?
There's not even a lot of dealers around. Like, you got to know somebody to get into this hobby.
Yeah.
I guess that's what somebody listening today will say. Yeah, what does this audiophile stuff? Well, you can start with the magazines, you know, like Stereophile and the Absolute Sound magazines. Those are still the premier audiophile magazines, and you can see, you know, all the products that are being made today in this world, in this high-end world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, to me, you don't really understand, like, all right, I got the two amps. Okay, those drive the speakers, and then I've just got this, let's say, receiver to plug the turntable into. Do the amps plug into the, like, let's say if I was running this Marantz, would I run the amps into this, or?
No,
or?
You'd have a separate, if you moved over to Manly World, you'd have a separate phono stage. And that would be either the Steelhead or the Chinook.
And that thing would plug into the phono stage here?
No. Then you'd plug that into... If you had an outboard phono stage, you could bring that into your Marantz receiver into a line input.
Right.
Because the output of a phono stage is line level.
Got ya.
And then also the power amplifiers, they want to see line level as well. But somewhere along the way, you need a way to change your volume.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that's why you have a preamplifier, like this Manly Jumbo Shrimp here. So there's five input line inputs.
Yeah.
And then volume and balance control.
Oh, I see right tunes. There. Oh, yeah. So technically you would run this and this.
That's right.
Gotcha. And then the monoblocks.
That's
right. And then you wouldn't have no receiver like that at all. This is all you'd have.
Yeah.
Oh, that's bitching.
All your sources would be separate.
Yeah, I got it now. I understand
but
now.
But for records, because you have to decode the RIAA.
You need this.
Yeah, and you need tons of gain. Records are special, and they need their own special preamplifier for that. Yeah.
Wow.
That's
you guys, the
thing.
You guys selling a lot of this stuff?
We have over the decades, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Because, I mean, it's hotter than ever right now, right? Vinyl's back.
Vinyl, yeah, the phono stages are the best-selling products, definitely, right now. There's a lot of competition in tube world and audiophile world. There's a lot of Chinese-built products. That
yeah, I see them. You see
cheap.
It? It looks like these cheap little monoblocks.
They're cheap, but I guess people buy them or they're, you know... I don't know. It's more expensive to produce stuff here in America. That's what I know.
Of course. Well, so, how many employees you guys got there?
22 right now.
Wow.
We've had up to 50, but our newer products are way more efficient to build, so we don't need as much labor.
That's crazy. So, I mean, so you got 25 employees. Do they got health care?
Oh, yeah. Hell
so they
yeah.
got health. There you go.
Yeah,
you got the health care. 401k.
Yeah.
You got rent on a building. You got the tubes just keep going up and up and up in price. Where are the tubes coming from now?
Russia, mainly Russia.
Only Russia, right?
Yeah, mainly.
And who's making them? Svetlana or whatever?
Svetlana was one of the factories. I don't know if they're in current production right now. We source most of our tubes out of a company called Electroharmonix.
Oh, yeah, I know them.
And he brings them in. He works with a couple other factories in Russia as well. And he's been, you know... a very important person in our world.
Yeah. He's
definitely.
The denim guy of denim jeans.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? No tube guy, no
like
tube amplifier.
Yeah,
same with the denim in Japan. You know, like this big mill just closed in America, and now there's no denim being made in America.
Oh, yeah?
And you got to have the Japanese connections.
Well, you know what the origin of denim is, right?
What's that?
It's French. It's from a town called Nîmes. So it's denim.
Yeah, denim.
That's where denim actually comes from. I only know this because I have a French business partner, and my other business venture,
What's your other venture?
You don't even know.
Yeah. What's your other business?
I'm importing these French motorcycle safety jeans.
Oh, wow.
You
ride?
Hell yeah.
Yeah. What do you ride?
All of them. I've got currently a 91 FXLR.
Oh, rad.
A 98 Triumph Thunderbird Sport, a 70 4850T Goodsy, and I just bought a little race bike for Chuck Walla.
Oh, wow. So that's your thing. I've been riding all my life.
I know. I thought that maybe we had met through motorbike people or something.
No. No.
So I was like, did we meet at the IMS show? No.
I got ran over on my FXR at a 92. It was absolutely mint, and it got destroyed a couple years back.
Oh, bummer.
But I got a Road King.
Yeah.
And I've been riding all my life. I love them all, man. I've been riding Ducatis for years, Harleys, and Beamers. Those three, nonstop.
I'm also a member of the Pasadena Motorcycle Club, which is a cool group of guys. It's the second oldest club in the world, actually. It was formed 107 years ago.
Wow.
In 1904.
You go any long trips, like ride to Sturgis or anything?
I've ridden across the country by myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't bothered with Sturgis. I ride in Vietnam.
Whoa, really?
I ride in France.
Yeah. Wow.
I go ride other places.
I've rode everywhere, man. I love it. It's just,
me too.
It's my life, you know?
Yeah.
But now I'm getting back into cars.
Are you? What do you have?
Yeah. Well, I'm just, I love all of them. You know what I mean? That's what I'm saying. I'm saying, like, I was into cars forever. I had a Dodge Super B, a 64 Cadillac. I had a Mercury Comet. Just cars.
You had a Mercury Comet?
Yeah, convertible.
That was my first car.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had a blue convertible. Oh, it was
a convertible Comet.
Yeah, like Daphne Blue. Convertible with three on the tree.
Really?
Yeah.
What year was that?
64. Not the early body. The one after that, you know what I mean? Because the first one had kind of the slant back end, you know, and then mine had the three taillights like an Impala.
Right.
You know?
Oh, God, that's a riot.
Yeah, it was slow as hell, but man, it was great.
Mine was from the early 70s. It was an old neighbor who gave it to me.
Oh, yeah.
He stopped driving and...
Oh, the 60s ones were the ones. They're just so, you know, they're so art deco and wild, you know.
That's awesome.
And Mercury Comet, you know, they made one with a big motor in it also.
They did.
Yeah, in the 60s, you know. But, yeah, cars, bikes, you know, and stereos and jeans. That's like my obsession. You know what I mean?
That's what I do, man.
Like
all the fun stuff.
Yeah, I started looking at your shit, and I was like, God, this stuff is dope, man. Now,
I'll show you the other company. The other company we're bringing the jeans in, the brand of the jeans is called Bollidster, and my importation company is called Unique. Well, I can't spell without my glasses. It's
I think it was, hold on.
EU.
EU.
N.
N.
I.
Is this it?
No.
Okay. N I.
Q U E.
Q U E.
.us.
.us.
Unique.us.
And this is like.
That's my importation company.
Oh, wow. There's your bike. I already know it's a.
Yeah.
I already know it's a low rider. You got the 21 single disc on the front.
That's
but let's look at these products a little bit. Wow, you're like a dual company.
I know.
Owner.
So
these are like denim?
Yeah, those motorbike jeans, you can slide like 50 feet in them before they break up.
Really? And what are they made of? A Japanese denim? Are they salvaged denim?
No, it's French.
Oh.
It's a French salvage denim.
Oh, it's salvage, huh?
The material is called Armalith, and it's got a polyethylene that's woven into the denim, and we make a ladies model as well.
Well, these are killer.
And there's models with a hip and knee armor and abrasion-only models as well.
So, I got you. No armor inside.
Right.
That's the type
the
I would
go. One model called the Ridester has...
This one here?
No.
Like, that's no... look at this Ruby helmet.
I know.
Hilarious. So, that's no armor in it, right? Right here?
Yeah.
It just looks like a regular jean, but it has something in it, like, if you slid down the highway, it doesn't shred apart, huh?
Right. It's not... And it's not Kevlar lined. It's not two layers. It's one layer, so they're nice and cool here in the summertime.
Wow.
And the other thing that's really neat about this material that makes it technologically superior to everything else out there is the geometry of how it's made. The polyethylene is always encased in the cotton, so it's never against your skin. It's never going to burn you and melt into your skin.
Oh, wow.
Like Kevlar can.
So...
Because when you're sliding, all that
heats
up, and then you're burning yourself.
I had some thick Japanese denim on, And I slid down the freeway, and I'll show them to you when we're done. And they fucking held up genius, man.
Really?
I got hit doing 70.
Damn.
And everything was great. They look like Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
But it didn't disintegrate. It just shredded into these like small holes. But the denim, you know, is 21 ounce. And it fucking held up perfect.
Damn.
Yeah.
Well, that's good news, because when you're sliding, usually you are moving around quite a lot.
Yeah, yeah,
so
right.
That's probably what literally saved your ass.
Right, because it doesn't slide on one spot.
Yeah,
it would just sand off.
Yeah.
Wow, how much are those?
So these guys, that Jeanster model retails for $349 here in the States.
Wow.
So, and I'm,
where do you sell them at?
You can buy them on our web store at unique.us, and that's EUNIQUE.US. And also here in town, BMW Burbank sells them.
Oh, that's my boy over there.
Who do you know over there?
I used to work for him.
You did?
Mike. He's the owner.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. So
yeah,
you
yeah.
can buy them there. They have full stock over there.
Now, it looks like you got some good slim cuts, like this one this guy's wearing right here. Hold on.
They're European
style. This one
styled.
Here? That looks good on this guy
they're
here.
They're styled for Europeans.
Yeah, that looks great.
Yeah, they're not baggy. They're not baggy jeans.
Right.
They're actually styled really nicely.
And how many ounces are they? Do you know?
They're physically a little lighter than your 501s.
Oh, so like a 10 ounce or something.
Yeah, I don't know
right.
ounce-wise
I gotcha.
That goes.
Look at this guy sanding them. He's like sanding them in the ad here.
They're super comfortable, and they don't look like you're wearing a bunch of motorcycle gear, so you can
that's why
you know,
I like it, because I go on stage. I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
So I never, you know, half the time I risk my life because I was like, well, I don't want to go on stage in this giant fucking outfit, you know what I mean? And people got, you're wearing leather head to toe, right? And it's like, well, it's 1,000 degrees
yeah,
out.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you'll pass out from sun.
Yeah. Oh,
heat,
absolutely.
You know,
you
from
get
the
overheated,
heat.
Yeah. For sure. So I don't ride with normal clothes anymore. I always wear my Bollitzer jeans.
And, wow.
But they look just like these jeans.
Yeah, they do. I'm looking at them. They look fantastic.
And I would have ridden one of my bikes today, but you told me to bring this tube amp.
Well, yeah, I really wanted to see it.
It's a little bulky, this thing.
I wanted to see it in person, man.
Yeah.
It's cool. I got I got a handmade episode and I got two different products. And they're two things that fucking my listeners would be into.
Exactly.
Motorcycle jeans and
music and motorbikes.
Yeah, and high-end audio.
That's what we like.
Now, where can they buy the Manly stuff? At the audio stuff.
Manly gear is sold all over the world. We've got dealers in many countries. I guess the best idea would be to go to manly.com, M-A-N-L-E-Y, and go look at where to buy, because there's dealers everywhere.
This stuff's amazing.
There's separate dealers for hi-fi gear versus pro audio gear.
Yeah, yeah, man. I love the look of this, the color.
Thanks.
It's that old blue military, kind of Neve, of course.
Gunmetal blue.
There's something about Neve and all that German stuff that
Telefunken and
that,
all.
Yeah, they just killed it, right?
Yeah, this is very classic, good-looking, handsome stuff.
I mean, that stuff, like, you know, to this day, these guys copy and make Neve preamps that are just a sleeve, you know, of one of the, it's hilarious, but it's the color of audio seems to be, and it's funny because there's a Porsche out right now that Singer did in this color, and I'm like, oh.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm like, what a great car.
You just got a Manly blue Porsche.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't know. Sometimes the audiophiles get a little scared by color, though, and some newer products we're working on, we're probably just going to offer them in silver and black.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, guys, I don't know. They get kind of scared, so.
And then you
don't want to scare anybody.
Your Instagram is Manly Labs.
Yeah.
And go on here. There's great photos of stuff in here, which, is really good. And I'm glad that you did the show, because it's so cool to meet somebody that just, you know, first of all, made in America, and second of all, these products are great. And then the motorcycle spill off. What a fucking double bonus. What's this here? This one, the snapper.
That's a 100-watt monoblock.
Oh, that's the I think what I need is two snappers and then those two pieces, and I would be, there it is, right?
There you go.
It'd be insane. What would that run? You go two monoblocks.
Those would be, we're just talking retail level. So those snappers are 7,000 something a pair. And then the cheaper Phonostage, the Chinook, is $2,500 retail. And then the like a Jumbo Shrimp preamplifier that's got remote control.
Right.
That guy's like right around $3,000 as well.
So. How much is $3,000?
So yeah, you'd be.
And then you need this thing too, right?
Well, I got you into the less expensive Chinook instead of the Steelhead.
Oh, these two. Gotcha.
Yeah. That's a Phonostage, and it's got adjustable loading and stuff, but it's on the back.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But yeah, you'd be on a retail level around $12,000 for that.
Woo-wee.
Sounds
man.
Good. Sounds good.
That sounds like a sponsorship coming up on the podcast.
Oh, my God.
Man, $12,000. But, man, that stuff's bulletproof, right? Is it all point-to-point in there? What's going on? Is there circuit boards?
There's circuit boards. The layouts of the boards, we try to minimize the distance that the audio is actually traveling on the board itself. It's mainly, when we're doing layouts, we mainly try to lay out the board so that the signal's kind of jumping from part to part, and the board's like holding the parts right close to each other, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's just intelligent, good circuit board design.
Right.
And it's far more reliable and repeatable for us to build it that way.
It is then more than a point-to-point soldering?
Yeah, it seems to be. I don't know.
Yeah, I was just
wondering. It's like everything's got a specific place to live, and it's very easy. It's easy to work on, too, when you're looking at a circuit board and you can trace the signal around.
Right. But audiophiles, they get into that nerdy shit, right? Of like, oh, no, I got to have this board with the... I mean, I know with guitar amps... All hand wired, you know, guitar amps, like say,
yeah,
like, you know.
It depends on, I don't know. I think it depends on some other construction factors too. I mean, the audio is brought in, it's hand wired coming in the chassis till it goes to the board, but it's, we've had very good reliability over the years, over the decades.
Yeah.
Building it this way.
What's the warranty on this stuff?
5 years.
5 years.
We've got excellent customer support. My guy Paul's been with us like about 20 years, I think, and we'll fix anything we've ever built, ever.
Really?
We won't ever turn anyone away.
Wow, that's rad. Mm. Well, all right. And so thanks a lot for doing the show.
Awesome.
Very cool to have you on. So thanks for
cool
tugging
to
that
you.
Fucking Stingray eye tube. That thing definitely looks like a thing from the past because it's got the iPod holster there. I love that.
This one is a thing from the past. There's the other model that's still made today that we scrapped the iPod dock on.
Right.
It's just something we could do because we could do it. The other thing, man, I hate infrared remote controls where you have to point and shoot.
Oh, yeah, thing. Yeah.
So all my products have remote radio frequency remotes.
Oh, no shit?
Yeah, and it's not like Bluetooth where you have to hassle and pair it or something.
Yeah, it's like just, a wireless microphone.
It's wireless, yeah, it's radio frequency.
Right, that's what I'm saying, that's what those are.
Yeah, so it's just, you can just have your remote sitting near you. You don't have to pick it up and point it anywhere. Or you can have it in another room and the phone rings, you can mute the amplifier.
Wow, that's rad.
I like that stuff.
Yeah,
I think
right?
That's neat, yeah.
Wow.
We were the first doing that in the hi-fi world. I know that.
Oh, all right. Well, thanks for coming by. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. That's how we keep the show in the top 100. And check out the manly.com website. Just great, great audio equipment. See you guys.